From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
The question was something like, do you have any regrets about killing the officer? As simple as that.
And what do you say that Mumia Abu-Jamal's response was?
His response was one word, yes.
The man who says Mumia Abu-Jamal confessed, and Abu-Jamal's attorney responds.
He claims he's recalling a very brief conversation 7 years ago that he never related to anyone, that he never wrote down, and that he never wrote to Mr. Jamal about. Am I correct in that?
All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Opposition activists have collected more than 150,000 signatures demanding the resignation of Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. The petition, sponsored by the Opposition Alliance for Change, has launched last week in 20 towns in Serbia. Vladan Batic, one of the alliance leaders, said. The alliance, a loose coalition headed by the opposition Democratic Party of Zoran Djindjic, has launched a series of anti-regime protests this month demanding Milosevic's resignation. Protests against Milosevic, halted recently by flooding, resumed yesterday in Belgrade. We now turn to Jeremy Scahill, who is Democracy Now!'s correspondent in Yugoslavia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Jeremy. What's happening?
Well, thank you, Amy. More than 5,000 people last night demonstrated in the city of Valjevo, which is about 60 miles southwest of Belgrade. These 5,000 people say that they were going to take over the municipal building there, which is run by the ruling Socialist Party of Slobodan Milosevic. They say that those 5,000 people have a right to govern themselves and that the Socialist Party must leave power. As they tried to take over the municipal building, police, more than two dozen police officers, blocked them from doing that. The demonstrators began smashing the windows, and eventually a group of them did make it into that building. They were then removed by force from the building by the police. They say they will continue to demonstrate there every day until they successfully take over that municipal building. But as I said, the police did use force against these demonstrators. They did try to prevent journalists and people from entering the city of Valjevo to try to prevent them from protesting. And there are several more protests planned tonight and in the next few days. These are all part of the demonstrations that are going to be taking place this summer, the summer many have called the summer of discontent. Now, meanwhile, the Alliance for Change, as you said earlier, announced that there are more than 30,000 people facing prosecution for conscientious objection to the fighting in Kosovo or for deserting or avoiding conscription. The Alliance for Change is publicly demanding that these people receive amnesty, and they say the only people who should be prosecuted are Slobodan Milosevic and his forces that led people into the war in Kosovo. Amy?
Thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy Scahill reporting from Belgrade, and we'll continue to have our War and Peace report tomorrow. In a flashback to the revolution that installed Iran's current government 20 years ago, baton-wielding police fired tear gas to disperse 10,000 protesters on the streets of Tehran yesterday, the sixth day of protests against hardliners who've thwarted reform efforts. The unrest that started Thursday has left two people dead and scores injured. It's the first time students and ordinary Iranians have taken to streets in such big numbers to confront the powerful hardliners opposing the political and social reforms of moderate President Mohammad Khatami, a hero of the protesters. The protests have spread to at least 10 other towns during the past days, highlighting the widespread frustration with the government. Here at home, in what's likely to be the whitest television season in a generation, not one of the 26 new shows set to debut on ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox will star an African-American. Blacks, along with Hispanics and Asian Americans, will occupy few secondary roles as well. The new season continues what amounts to a disappearing act for African-Americans and black-themed shows during the 1990s. The trend has alarmed the nation's largest civil rights organization, the NAACP. At its national convention in New York yesterday, President Kwasi Mfume blasted the ebbing diversity and suggested that legal action could be warranted. Mfume, who called for federal hearings on station and network ownership, said the NAACP plans to monitor the movie and TV industry out of its new branch in Hollywood. He said the NAACP is actively exploring litigation against the four networks and boycotts of their sponsors. Globalization is compounding the gap between rich and poor nations and intensifying American dominance of the world's economic and cultural markets. This according to the latest Human Development Report published by the United Nations Development Program. The 262-page study is the first to focus on the spread of the Internet and computer technology, as well as the impact of globalization. It concludes that rules of globalization should be rewritten to save the 60 countries that are worse off than they were in 1980 from falling even further behind. So as to make international markets work for people rather than profits, the work recommends faster debt relief, redirection of aid to the poorest countries, and a task force to review global government. It also endorses a tax of 1 American cent on lengthy emails to raise $70 billion a year that could be used to connect the world's internetless.
From the blood-stained soil beneath my feet.
You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. African-American journalist and death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal says a magazine article that reports he expressed regret for killing a police officer is a rumor turned lie. Abu-Jamal, who's maintained his innocence, released a statement from prison Friday night saying Vanity Fair was wrong and that he had never been contacted about the allegation by former prison volunteer Philip Block. "A lie is a lie," Abu-Jamal said. "I find it remarkable that this rumor-turned lie was never brought to my attention by the author, by Mr. Block himself, or by Vanity Fair magazine, which never contacted me. Welcome to snuff journalism." The article's author, Buzz Bissinger, wrote that attempts to contact Abu-Jamal and his lawyer, Leonard Weinglass, were unsuccessful. Abu-Jamal, a former Black Panther, was found guilty of killing Officer Daniel Faulkner in 1981. Police arriving at the scene found the dying officer and a wounded Abu-Jamal. An officer and hospital worker testified during the trial that Abu-Jamal confessed to the killing. Block, who befriended Abu-Jamal through his work with the prison reform organization Pennsylvania Prison Society, told the magazine in its August issue that they often discuss subjects from prison life to philosophy. Block said he came forward because of his disgust with the tactics of those who believe Abu-Jamal was wrongly convicted. Abu-Jamal says he's innocent and blames his conviction on a biased judge and an ineffective lawyer. His writings and efforts to win a new trial have attracted worldwide attention. We should say that Buzz Bissinger, who is the reporter who wrote the Vanity Fair piece, also wrote a book about the mayor of Philadelphia, Ed Rendell, who was the city's district attorney in 1981-1982 when Abu-Jamal was tried. Bissinger was referred to by N. Rendell as his aide when he would sit in on various meetings as he shadowed Rendell for 4 years writing the book about his career. Today's show will be in three parts. In the first, we'll hear from Philip Block as he tells his story. We then go to the president of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, which dismissed Block years ago due to what they said was his violation of their rules. And then we'll hear from Leonard Weinglass, Abu-Jamal's attorney, as he talks to Philip Block for the first time. But we begin with Philip Block, the man who says that Mumia Abu-Jamal indirectly confessed to him more than 8 years ago.
When I was visiting Mumia, I was a college student at junior high college. Mumia was across the river about a mile, sitting on death row in B Block. I was working for the Pennsylvania Prison Society. I went over to the prison because I believed that I had a moral responsibility to try to help those inmates who are very isolated from their families and aren't always subjected to the best treatment in rural communities. So that was why I was going to the prison. I was working with other inmates, and I'd recently found out that my great-grandfather had been executed in Pennsylvania for murder, and I had mentioned that to another inmate on death row that I was trying to help. and he was friends with Mumia, and Mumia found out about this, and he wanted to meet me. That was how our relationship started. Mumia asked me to come into the prison and call him out so that we can meet. That was how our relationship started. It went on from there. We had a lot in common. We're about the same age. We went through the same period of American history, having to address the same issues. And we had a lot of past experiences and left-wing causes in common. So that was how the friendship developed. And all the numerous visits that I made to Mumia after that were strictly visits to one friend to another. I never went in there trying to address or help a problem Mumia had with the institution. He didn't have problems with the institution. They sort of deferred to inmates on death row, and Mumia was probably a model prisoner. He probably still is. So there's never any paperwork that exists showing that I ever did any administrative work. The only reason I was not on Mumia's family and friends list was because I could see any inmate in the state of Pennsylvania that I wanted to. And I was never going to, we were never told to bump somebody else off of a friends and family list in order to get us on, because we had access to any inmate. That's why when Mumia says now that my visits to him were just as an official visitor with the prison society, that's misleading. That's just totally misleading. I went in to talk to my friend Mumia.
And
he wanted
me
in there. I never went to see him once of all the times I saw him where he refused to see me. He wanted to see me because we enjoyed our intellectual discussions.
And, Philip, what year did you see him, and how many times did you see him?
It would have started in 90 and either ended in my, as I've told everybody every time I interview, my memory of that period, it's all jumbled together. It started definitely in 90, and whether it ended in sometime in 91 or early 92, I can't really recollect. Number of visits, I told Bus Bissinger it was 10. I was trying to be conservative. Anybody that's interested can go to the prison and see if they still have the records of how many times I visited there. My relationship was well known in the prison. It wasn't particularly liked by the people who ran the prison. I imposed on Mumia because of our friendship to write a weekly column for the local college newspaper. I edited the column. He was I appreciated it because I was trying to bridge the gap between the prison and the college community. So I don't know, remember the exact number of visits. Somebody would have to do their legwork to figure that out.
And
but
what,
it went on for a long time.
And
so I was banned from the prisons. I was banned from the prisons as a security risk to the prisons.
When was that?
That would have been late 91, early 92. That was when I stopped being able to get in to see Mumia.
Can you tell us what Mumia Abu-Jamal told you?
Well, I have to lay some kind of context first, or it doesn't make any sense. I mean, the context is that when I met Mumia, we became friends, and I was a very ardent supporter of Mumia. In fact, a couple times in the college paper, or at least once that I can remember, I wrote things very favorable. I was saying Mumia's in prison because of misconduct of the police. I mean, I wanted to believe that Mumia was innocent. And I tried to organize support on the college campuses long before Mumia has become as popular as he is now. And it was very hard, but I was out there championing his cause. There came a point, probably sometime in 91, when I realized that my support of Mumia is basically just emotional because of our friendship. So I made the trek up to Petit Library in Penn State, and I went and poured through all the old Philadelphia Inquirer microfiche, and I looked at all the evidence of the trial, and I had to very reluctantly conclude that my friend had indeed murdered the officer. I could see no other scenario that made sense to me. So I reluctantly at that point made that conclusion. It didn't change my relationship with Mumia. It didn't change the way I felt about Mumia because of his nonviolent past and just my conversations with him. I considered him a very nonviolent person. And I just considered that an aberration because things weren't going well for him at the time. And I realized his feelings towards the police are deep-seated, and it just erupted, unfortunately, that morning. Later on, I'm not sure exactly how later on, in one of our discussions, the question came up. Why did the question come up? Because in my own mind, I already was assuming that as a fact, that Mumia unfortunately had murdered the officer. We were having a discussion in which I was trying to reevaluate my own views towards violence. I was a pacifist for a long time. I was at that time reevaluating my views. And my feelings were that I don't know whether I could really live with myself if I killed somebody. And it was in the context of me trying to thrash out in my own mind whether it's permissible in certain occasions to use violence in order to avert a greater evil, whether it's useful. So I'm talking about this, and we're going back and forth. And I just happened to ask Mumia, and this is as best as I can remember, I've told everybody, do you have any regrets about killing the officer? It wasn't something I planned to ask him when I went in there. I never asked any inmate that I visited whether he was guilty or not. That wasn't my style. I didn't intend to ask Mumia that day, and that was when I got the response, the one-word response. And there was a pause, and after that, I think we both realized what was said, and the conversation went off on a tangent. And that was it. And I never told a soul about it until I told Mrs. Faulkner at the end of April this year.
Can you say again what the question was that you asked Mumia Abu-Jamal?
The question was something like, do you have any regrets about killing the officer? As simple as that.
And what do you say that Mumia Abu-Jamal's response was?
His response was one word, yes.
And why have you held on to this information if this conversation took place for, what is it, about 7 years now?
7 or 8 years, yeah. Well, people have asked me, why didn't you, Sam Donaldson asked me, why didn't I go to the authorities right then? And it was an off-the-wall question. Why? He's on death row. I don't want to see him executed. I still don't want to see him executed. Why would I go? It's a good question. Why did I go now? But back then, I was still a supporter of him after this. I was still trying to get support from him for a little bit of time, and then there was an estrangement. We had a serious disagreement over an issue when we were just at the point where we could only correspond through mail. And for whatever reason, Mumia chose to stop corresponding with me.
What was the disagreement over?
The disagreement was a philosophical issue of personal responsibility for actions. It was in the aftermath of the Rodney King riots. And one of the things I had written in a letter to Mumia was my really disgust at what had occurred, and I thought that the people who dragged Reginald Denny out of his truck and beat him should be held to fully, feel the full brunt of the law. Mumia, in his next letter back to me, told me that no, he didn't think they should. He thought they were the victims. They were victims having to grow up in white racist society.
Do you have that letter?
No, I never kept any of the letters. They were thrown away years ago, I think, when I moved when I left college. But that was the crux of the disagreement between us. And I, in my own mind, I tried to keep, a few times write letters to Mumia, and he never responded. In my own mind, I figured that if he thinks they should be held responsible for their actions, knowing what I know at that point, maybe he feels that I'm going to feel the same way about him someday. But he should be held responsible for his actions. And shortly after that, he was transferred to this brand new facility, and I just gave up trying to get in contact with him. But that's the most serious thing that somebody can say to me, is tell me that they're not responsible for their actions. So if that was Mumia's way of telling me that he didn't want to take responsibility for his actions, it caused me to lose a lot of respect for him at that point.
That was years ago. If the letter was as you describe it, still, that's about 5 years ago. What made you decide to come forward now?
7 years ago at that point. I don't think I've ever written a letter to me in over 7 years now.
And so, what made you decide to come forward now?
The only reason I've come forward now is because, as the article said, my disgust with the tactics of certain people who are supporting Mumia. I've distanced myself from it. I very rarely even think about it anymore, but I happened to be on the Internet one day, and I was looking at Mumia's websites and seeing what was being said, and I happened to find some link over to a website for the officer that was slain. And I started looking through there, and it was just some of the stuff that I heard that was being done to this poor woman was just beyond the pale to me. I just think it's indecent. And I'm the kind of person who Mia is, who's always trying to champion the underdog. I just have nothing but compassion for the woman. And I think that some of the stuff that's being said and some of the attempts to vilify the memory of her husband are just unconscionable.
Philip Block, a prison volunteer who was kicked out of the organization he worked for, the Pennsylvania Prison Society, he says in the early 1990s, Mumia Abu-Jamal allegedly confessed to him indirectly about the killing of William Faulkner, Daniel Faulkner. When we come back, we'll hear more from Philip Block, and we'll also hear from the president of the Pennsylvania Prison Society. Then we'll go to Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney, Leonard Weinglass. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers, as we continue with Philip Block, a prison volunteer in the early 1990s, who says in a conversation with Mumia Abu-Jamal, he indirectly confessed to the killing of police officer Daniel Faulkner. Again, Philip Block, the man who is speaking, who I interviewed yesterday, says, or the prison society he was working for kicked him out for violations of their policies. He's now talking about Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner.
I just initially just wanted to make this woman feel better. I sent her an anonymous email initially, and I eventually told her who I was, and I disclosed this to her because I thought it would make her feel better if she knew that Mumia really, I don't forget about his public persona that he's presenting, that he really regretted what he did. And she became, you know, of course she was appreciative, but she was concerned that if there would be a new trial at some time, that she would want me to testify, and if something happened to me and I wasn't around or something, you know, happened to me, she wanted me to make a statement to the police, so I agreed to do that. And then after that, she said there were a couple of journalists that she respected a lot as being fair, and she would really appreciate it if I would, talk to them. And at that point, I just couldn't say no to her. And there's more on top of that. I mean, I see a lot of naive, idealistic college people out there who are being taught to hate because they believe that an innocent man has been convicted of a crime, is going to be executed because of his political beliefs. And if that were true, that would be outrageous. But unfortunately, it's not true. This is the real world. You know, for everybody on the left out there, I understand why your world would make a lot more sense if Mumia was innocent. I felt the same way. But this is the real world. It's not a fairy tale world of good versus evil. This is the real world. Mumia is a human being. He made a serious mistake. Unfortunately, one morning back in December of 1981, he became everything that he's opposed to. Mumia and I are opposed to a society that dehumanizes people, that turns people into objects for exploitation, in which governments engage in senseless violence. This is our common bond of philosophy. Unfortunately, one morning, Mumia became the agent that dehumanized somebody who happened to be wearing a police uniform, and he executed him. You know, and as bad as that is, that's the truth.
Philip,
that's just the way it is, and you have to make your peace with that, and then go out and don't go out and join this bandwagon because you need some excuse to hate something about America. Go out and try to constructively change society. You know, that's my position. I just think that there may be somebody further down the line who's going to commit some senseless act of violence just because of the hatred that's being stirred up. And I can see the protesters and their actions, just like what happened down at the Liberty Bowl on the 4th of July, and there's just so much hatred in the air that it's just appalling. And that is, you know, one of the reasons also that I came forward. I want to put a stop to that. It's just gone too far.
Philip, when you were visiting Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row, did the police ever try to contact you? Because certainly they had a record of your visits, or the prison authorities.
No. They didn't know what was going on. Our visits are confidential. They have no idea why me and I are talking. I mean, they figured it out after a while. They figured out, you know, Mumia's not having any problems with the prison. Well, you know, they're just friends, you know. But they figured Mumia might be helping me with my investigation of the criminal beatings by guards of the inmates. But there was never any retaliation.
Why were you banned from the prison?
Because during that period, I was also made aware by inmates, me and others, that the prison had a gang of guards who would, if an inmate needed taught a lesson, would go around, you know, drag him into a shower room and, you know, and work him over a little, teach him a lesson. So I went to the prison society. They told me that they had an agreement with the United States Justice Department that if we compiled enough evidence of a pattern of behavior, that they would come in and investigate. So that was the tune they gave me. I provided the lyrics. I went in, you know, I got tipped off when it happened by inmates. I went in, compiled the evidence, interviewed the inmates, documented any physical evidence as well as I could, and I compiled the evidence. But when push came to shove, then everybody started backing off. They don't want to pursue it. And the State Bureau of Corrections put tremendous pressure on the prison society to have me back off, and I refused to back off. And eventually it came to a head, and I was given the choice of resigning or discontinuing my investigation. And I told them they were cowards, and I left.
You told the Pennsylvania Prison Society?
I told the director of the Pennsylvania Prison Society he was a coward. We met in Harrisburg, and I said, I'm not going to sacrifice these inmates so that you can run your programs for parolees without any, you know, hindrance from the Bureau of Corrections.
So you were forced to resign then, or you resigned?
Well, I was kicked out. I was told that I was banned. I was told that I could never go back into a prison. Now, I imagine if I had a relative in there, I might have been able to get back in, but I was told that I could not even be put on the visitor's list for somebody. That's why I was never able to visit anybody again.
And that is Philip Locke, a prison volunteer, who says that 8 years ago, about that time, in a conversation with death row prisoner Mumia Abu-Jamal, Abu-Jamal indirectly confessed to him. He says he did not reveal this conversation to anyone until this past few months. We're now going to turn to David Lauder, who is the president of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, an organization that's more than 200 years old, that sends volunteers into the prison to do conflict resolution. I reached him late last night at his home and asked him first about what Philip Block had said about why he was fired, his allegation that he was trying to investigate prison guard brutality in the prisons, that the Pennsylvania Prison Society had a deal with the Justice Department, that if they gathered evidence, they could give it over to the Justice Department. And Block went on to say that the Pennsylvania Prison Society was cowardly and backed off in the end and would not present that evidence. I put this question to David Lauder.
Well, the Prison Society has never had an agreement with the Justice Department, either federal or state, to investigate any brutality in state prisons. So I'm at a loss to know why he had that idea. We have many rules for our official prison visitors as guidance, and they agree to follow all of those rules if before they are issued an official prison visitor's card. And in Philip Block's case, he was in violation of at least one of those rules, and the committee removed his visiting privileges.
What was that violation?
Well, I'm not going to get into that. There are several different violations, and it's not important as to which one. He violated one of the rules that all volunteers agree to. And he agreed to it and didn't follow through on his end of the agreement.
Now, he says he never had to sign anything.
Well, we don't issue cards to people that have not received that agreement. If in a case of that he did not, for whatever reason, and I can't give you chapter and verse on the, because we've had several hundred volunteers out there, this these rules are well known. We discuss them. Our conveners for each team has those rules and oversees the actions of people, and so the rules are well known, and so I would suspect that he was well aware of them, and I'm sure that our director of programs, before he was removed, gave him a chance to change his behavior.
On the issue of Philip Block's revealing Mumia Abu-Jamal's alleged indirect confession, what's your response to that?
My response to that specific quote is that all of our official prison visitors operate under a confidentiality agreement where anything that is exchanged between a prisoner and one of our volunteers is confidential unless we are given specific permission by the inmate to release that to others that the inmate directs us to release it to.
David Lauder, it sounds like Philip Block in one fell swoop delivers two major blows, one to Mumia Abu-Jamal, the man who cut off communications with him years ago, and the second to the Pennsylvania Prison Society, which kicked him out several years ago.
Well, yes, we must remember that he has not been an official prison visitor for 6 or 7 years because we removed him from that capacity. So we don't have any control over anything that he wants to allege that he said while he was an official prison visitor. But we operate under a rule of complete confidentiality, and we've established that with prisoners over the better than 200 years in which we've been doing this work. And this, to my knowledge, is the first public violation of that trust that I know of.
Well, some might say it's important to have the trust of prisoners. Others might say, well, something else is more important here, and that is if a prisoner confesses, that should be made public. What's your response to that?
That is something that's a judgment, of course, that each person has to make within themselves, but it's not much different than a statement being made to a clergyman or made to an attorney, that the person making that statement believes it is privileged information, and we treat it on that basis.
Now, his response, I think, to that would be that he wasn't dealing with Mumia Abu-Jamal as a client, that Abu-Jamal was a model prisoner, and that he was using the Pennsylvania Prison Authority, Philip Block, that is, was simply using the card that gets him free access to prisoners to have extended conversations with Mumia Abu-Jamal. And so he wasn't obligated to him in the way that you are to a client you might be working with.
Well, you have just touched on one of the violations of our rules and protocol in using the official prison visitor's card. It's not for visiting privileges with inmates. It's for interviews with inmates that have specific problems that we try to deal with. It's not for extended private or social visits with inmates.
At the time, do you know, in talking to the other people, administrators of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, did anyone talk about Philip Block telling them that Mumia Abu-Jamal had allegedly confessed?
No, I have never ever heard anything like that until I read it on the weekend in the paper.
Does it surprise you that Philip Block came out with this something like, what, 7, 8 years later?
As chairman of this committee, knew the names of a lot of our volunteers out there. I didn't know them all well enough to make a judgment as to whether I would expect one of the volunteers, whether it be Philip or another one, to make a statement like that. I can't make a judgment.
I'm sure this has certainly been a topic of conversation among the Pennsylvania Prison Society administrators. Maybe you didn't know Philip Block personally, but the other people who worked with him, are they surprised that Philip Block is saying this, or does this fit in?
Well, Michael Hackman would have been, who was director of programs, knew Philip Block the best. He knew all of our volunteers the best. He was the one that recommended that he be removed as an official prison visitor, so I would suspect that he would not be completely surprised that, you know, I think he might have been surprised at the importance of the statement that he made, but I don't think he would be surprised that necessarily that Philip was acting on his own.
Is there anything else you want to add?
One concluding statement I would have on this subject, Amy, is that we have several hundred active volunteers across the state who work very hard in calling on prisons, both county and state, and it's a very thankless job. Many people don't understand why we do it, and we are dealing with people who are in trouble and sometimes are suspicious of us, and when something like this arises, it can bring our credibility into question with the inmates and with the state Department of Corrections, and this is harmful to our work, which has been going on for over 210 years on this basis, and I think in fairness to all of the volunteers that we have out there, that they should be recognized for their work. And that this particular instance with an ex-volunteer of ours removed because of rule violations shouldn't reflect on the rest of our very dedicated volunteer, both staff and the unpaid volunteers that are out working across the state.
David Lauder is the president of the Pennsylvania Prison Society, an organization that is more than 200 years old, extremely rare in this country as they have hundreds of volunteers over the years going into the Pennsylvania prisons to do conflict mediation between prisoners and the prison authorities. Well, when we come back from our break, we're going to hear from Leonard Weinglass, the attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal. But right now, I thought I'd read the statement of Mumia Abu-Jamal that he put out on July 9th, 1999, in response to Philip Block's allegations. He said, "Once again, we hear about a so-called confession, but instead of 2 months later, this comes over a decade later. We don't hear it from a priest, from a lawyer, or from a personal friend, but from an official visitor of the Pennsylvania Prison Society over 10 years later. A lie is a lie, whether made today or 10 years later, but I suppose Mr. Block wanted his 15 minutes of fame, in which case I hope he's received it. I find it remarkable that this rumor turned lie was never brought to my attention by the author, by Mr. Block himself, or by Vanity Fair magazine, which never contacted me. Welcome to snuff journalism." Mumia Abu-Jamal goes on to say, "I look forward to the state producing this witness, Mr. Block, after I'm granted a new trial. The only thing worse than a forgotten confession is one allegedly born on the false wings of harassment. If ever one needed proof of the state's desperation, here it is. I thank Vanity Fair, not for their work, but for stoking this controversy, because controversy leads to questioning, and one can only question this belated confession." You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! When we return, the spokesperson for, the lawyer for, death row prisoner and journalist Mumia Abu-Jamal. Please stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue with this story that has come out in the last week of a prison volunteer, Philip Block, who says that years ago he spoke to Mumia Abu-Jamal and that he indirectly confessed to him by saying he regretted killing police officer Daniel Faulkner. It's a story he told no one for many years and recently contacted Daniel Faulkner's widow, Maureen Faulkner. I did this interview yesterday, both with Philip Block as well as Mumia Abu-Jamal's attorney, Leonard Weinglass. Len Weinglass, I was wondering what your thoughts are right now and what Mumia Abu-Jamal's response is.
Well, my thoughts are really a bunch of questions to Mr. Block. I understand, if I understand him correctly, that he claims he's recalling a very brief conversation 7 years ago that he never related to anyone, that he never wrote down, and that he never wrote to Mr. Jamal about. Am I correct in that?
That happened, you know, 7 or 8 years ago. I didn't write it down. I didn't never told anybody. But I think we all know enough about memory that the things that you remember are those things that are most meaningful, those things that are
right,
unusual.
But you allowed for the fact that you can't remember the exact phrasing that you used in the questions.
Well, we both know enough about memory to know that it's not always, you know, completely 100%,
yeah, that's
reliable. I mean, I don't see where these questions are going. I'm not on trial here, and I'm not going to, you know, sit and answer those kind of questions. I mean, I've been talking all day on the phone. My voice is leaving me.
Yes, well, I don't want to be unfair to you either, but you are making some serious accusations against someone, and you have gone to the police, and you've talked to the police. And you've talked to Mrs. Faulkner. I'm just asking you. You and I haven't spoken at all, and I'm just asking you a few questions. I hope that's not too.
Yeah, but these are questions as if I'm sitting on a witness stand. I mean, you know, if the time ever comes when Amelia gets a new trial, I hope that they do examine the penalty phase of his trial. That's,
you know,
what I hope.
Let me ask you this: you've never read the trial transcript?
I only read what has been printed in
the newspaper.
Philadelphia Inquirer, maybe some other sources that I've come across.
So you formed your opinion about his guilt from reading the newspaper?
Initially, yeah.
Did you ever write to him and tell him that he acknowledged that he did it?
No, I never wrote a letter, you know, saying, I realized that you acknowledged to me that you did it. No.
Right. As a matter of fact, didn't you write him a letter in which you said you read the newspapers, and from what you read in the newspapers, you thought he was guilty? And it was at that point that he never again corresponded to you?
I don't think that's true at all.
You never wrote him that you felt that he was guilty based on what you've read?
I have no recollection of writing that.
You might have.
Well, I have no recollection. I mean, it doesn't make any sense.
And wasn't it that letter that ended your correspondence with him?
No, the letter that ended was the dispute over whether these other people should be held guilty. That was a dispute. We were never discussing Mumia's guilt or innocence.
When you gave a statement to the Philadelphia detective in the police department, did he record your statement?
I don't think so, but who knows?
Did he have you sign a statement?
Of course. That's customary.
I
don't want to be impolite, but I've answered enough of these questions. I'm not on a witness stand. I don't see any point in this. You wanted to hear what I had to say.
Well, the point is, you've gone public. You're going to have a press conference tomorrow.
Well, that may or may not go to a press conference tomorrow.
You're accusing a man of a crime for which he might be executed, and you object to the fact that people question you.
I'm not objecting to people asking me questions, but I'm objecting to, you know, news people asking me questions. I'm objecting to being subjected to the cross-examination as if I'm on the witness stand.
Yeah, but I am the only person who is speaking for Mr. Jamal, and I'm asking you the kinds of questions they don't ask you. And I'm trying to get to the truth here. That's
why
I asked.
How many questions have I answered so far for you? A dozen? 20?
Well, Philip, let me ask you a question, because I just am seeing the Associated Press report of Mumia Abu-Jamal's response, who says that your conversation with him, where he expressed regret for killing a police officer, is a rumor turned lie. That's what Mumia Abu-Jamal says.
Right, I read it.
He said that Vanity Fair was wrong and that he'd never been contacted about the allegation by you, Philip. He said, a lie is a lie. I find it remarkable that this rumor turned lie was never brought to my attention by the author, by Mr. Block himself, or by Vanity Fair magazine, which never contacted me. Welcome to snuff journalism. What's your comment on that?
Well, I understand why he feels it necessary to say that, but it's unfortunate. It saddens me. You know, I'm sure Buzz Bissinger tried to contact me. He's too professional a journalist not to do it. Why I didn't contact him is obvious. Our relationship has been estranged now for a long time.
Well, let me ask Len Weinglass. In the article, the Vanity Fair piece, it says attempts both in writing and through his lawyer, which is you, I guess, Len, made by Vanity Fair to interview Abu-Jamal were unsuccessful. Did Vanity Fair contact you to try to reach Mumia Abu-Jamal?
Buzz Bissinger did, and I told him that would have to be in a letter directly to Mr. Jamal. And he, of course, like everyone else, could write to Mumia. The mail does get through. Media representatives do write him. He responds. But from what I understand, he never heard from Mr. Bissinger or from Vanity Fair. He asked me if Mumia would agree to be interviewed. And I told him, I asked Mumia about that, and Mumia said, I'm willing to be interviewed by an objective reporter. I am not willing to be interviewed by a man who, in effect, served as a public relations director for the district attorney who prosecuted me. Certainly Vanity Fair must be able to find someone else to do the interview. And I, in fact, wrote Vanity Fair before the article was published, asking them to find someone else who was not so aligned in the case with either side. They decided to go ahead with Mr. Bissinger. Could I just ask one last question?
All right, one last question.
In terms of your recall, is it possible that you would have asked Mumia, as a humanist, did he ever feel badly about the fact that Officer Faulkner was killed? And to that question, he answered yes.
I don't remember ever asking that question.
Might you have?
I don't think so. I know the question that I ask, and I know the context of the, I mean, as I already explained, the context of the conversation.
You never asked him if he felt badly that Officer Faulkner was killed that night.
I have no recollection of ever asking him that.
Mm-hmm. But you will allow for the fact that over the period of 7 years, that might have been the nature of that question when he gave you a one-word answer, which was yes.
Well, I vividly remember the conversation, and that wasn't it. I already explained the conversation, Leonard, and...
Did you tell anyone, Philip, at the time of that conversation? Did you walk out and tell a close friend?
No, I never told anybody.
Why?
As soon as you start telling people things, you have no control over it anymore. There's no point in anybody knowing it. That was between me and me. It was a confidence. I don't take it lightly, breaking a confidence, but...
When you read in the newspapers, you also read back, and when you read the newspapers, that Mrs. Faulkner was suffering from the loss of her husband. Didn't you? You read that. That was in the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Well, I don't think I'd have to read it to imagine that happening. I mean,
and for 7 years, you never sought to alleviate that suffering.
That's true.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I
have no other questions.
Can I step down?
What do you think about, you just said that the reason you never told anyone, you kept this, did you keep it a complete secret?
Yeah, I didn't tell anybody.
The reason that you didn't tell anyone is that it could get out of your control once you release the information. So now the story that you have put forward is out there. Are you concerned that it will get out of your control? And that it will expedite the execution of Mumia Abu-Jamal?
I thought about that a lot. And if I thought that, I would never have come forward. I just, anything I say is moot, unless there's a new trial, as far as I can see. Now, I understand that when courts make decisions, that part of their consideration is if there were irregularities, what would happen if there were a new trial? Would it change the verdict? I guess in some
marginal way. You know, possibly it could, but I just don't think that anything I say is going to be the determining factor. So the answer to the question is no, I don't think so. And I would do everything in my power to convince the people that, you know, Governor Ridge or anybody else, not to do it.
Has
if it meant anything, if what I said meant anything to any of those people, I would try to intervene to stop it. I just think that the tactics that Mumia is pursuing and the method of doing it is going to almost ensure that they want to execute him, because, you know, the people that he needs to convince that he shouldn't be executed are not the people that are being reached by these protests. And the hatred that they're engendering is just going to backfire. That's why, I just think that it's the wrong approach.
Right.
And I think, unfortunately,
strategy and tactics, and you think your approach would be more effective than the approach that's being taken.
Well, I mean, time's only going to tell. I mean, my approach is based on my own beliefs about things.
Right.
I just think I can't imagine the state executing somebody who asked for mercy. I mean, in my mind, I just can't.
Are you familiar with Carla Faye Tucker in Texas?
Pardon me?
Are you familiar with Carla Faye Tucker in
Texas? Right, I'm familiar with that.
Did she ask for mercy?
I believe she did.
Yes, and she was executed, of course.
Of course she was, and I concede that on this point, I just maybe can considerably naive or idealistic about it. So I understand the strategy. I just don't agree with a lot of the tactics.
Right.
Len Weinglass, on the issue of whether or not Mumia Abu-Jamal has actually said that he is innocent, one of the points that the Vanity Fair article makes is he has never outright declared that. What is your response?
Well, I'd like to quote from the transcript of the trial in 1982 when Mumia addressed the jury for the first time during the penalty phase. And this is what he said, quote, "I am innocent of these charges that I've been charged of and convicted of, despite the connivance," and then he went on about the judge. Then he finished by saying, "but I am still innocent of these charges." And then he concluded by saying, "I'm innocent despite what you 12 people think, and the truth shall set me free." At that time, Mumia was under oath, and he was subjected to cross-examination. So he said he was innocent three times before the jury while under oath and subject to cross-examination. It couldn't be any more clear in the transcript.
Did they cross-examine him?
Yes, he was cross-examined. And when they cross-examined him, that's when they went into the Black Panther Party in an interview that Mumia gave 12 years earlier when he was 16 years old.
Saying that?
Trying to show to the jury in the penalty phase that Mumia, as a young man, was a Black Panther and was therefore antagonistic to the police. And somehow this 12-year hiatus between the time he was a Panther and the time he's now 28 is what produced, in effect, the shooting of the police officer.
Did Mumia Abu-Jamal ever say that he did not shoot William Faulkner, as opposed to say he's innocent of the charges?
Has he said it to me and to others? The answer is yes. At the trial, and he was speaking at the conclusion of his trial, he was speaking legally. The jury had just convicted him, and he said, "No, I am innocent of these charges." But he was never questioned by the prosecutor, "Did you shoot Officer Faulkner?" If he had been, he would have said no.
And what about all of these years? I mean, so often you have people who are prisoners who are wrongly convicted who declare their innocence and say, "I am innocent. I did not shoot this person or kill this person." We have not heard that from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Well, Mumia has said it to those who've asked him, and he has said it to his jury, in a sense, when he had the opportunity to speak. If you could get through to him, if they would allow you to speak to him and you would ask him, "Did you shoot Officer Faulkner?" you would get a straight-out answer.
Haven't you often said that that would be reserved for a new trial?
No, what I have said is his testimony as to what happened precisely that night will be given by Mumia under oath and subject to cross-examination, at a time when he has a court proceeding. Up to this point in time, he has not had a court proceeding because he's been before Judge Szabo.
Finally, Len Weinglass, what is the effect of what Philip Block has to say, actually legally, whether it's true or not? I mean, the trial is over at this point. Mumia Abu-Jamal is on death row.
The trial is over, but if Mumia were to get a new trial, Philip Block, I assume, could be a potential witness to an admission. As you know, is the second or third time they've put forward someone to say that Mumia has confessed. The others waited months, and they were not to be believed, according to an investigation by Stuart Taylor, the American lawyer who looked into this, found it to be a total fabrication. I think this one also would fall by the wayside. I can't imagine a jury accepting this kind of testimony, given what it is, and given that he waited 7 years before he told anyone about this alleged statement.
The earlier testimony, the earlier so-called confessions were one before Gary Bell, the partner of Daniel Faulkner, who didn't reveal this for a couple of months. And what was the second one?
The second one was a statement that Priscilla Durham, a security guard, claimed that she also heard. But she claimed she reported it that night, but the alleged written report is missing, was never found, and her testimony is also subject to the same kind of credibility attack because she never told the police either until they questioned her 2 months later.
And in terms of public opinion, the court of public opinion, does that court matter now in terms of the Pennsylvania governor signing a death warrant against Mumia Abu-Jamal? And would it be considered by the United States Supreme Court? Because I assume this case will go to the Supreme Court even before a new trial.
Yes, the case is now pending in the Supreme Court. But where I think this statement might figure is I'm sure the prosecutor will attempt to use it to dissuade a federal district court judge from having a hearing and granting a new trial, because the prosecutor will argue now with this latest confession, Mumia's chances of winning a new trial are less. It's a bogus argument. I'm sure they'll make it. I can't imagine any fair-minded judge granting it, but it's a hurdle, obviously, that we're going to have to cross.
Leonard Weinglass, the attorney for Mumia Abu-Jamal on death row. Mumia Abu-Jamal says that the Vanity Fair piece and the allegations of Philip Block, a prison volunteer, that he confessed to him are not true. That does it for today's show. To order a cassette, 1-800-735-0230. 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Produced by Maria Carrion, David Love, Errol Maitland, Technical Director. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
This Way Out family, I'm Greg Gordon. We thank you for listening on KHSR Fredericton, New Brunswick, WDIY Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, KRZA Alamosa, Colorado, and more than 100 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Please do stay tuned.